Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we try to share an idea on the Parsha through the lens of Jewish history, based on all of the wonderful books and articles that I try to read each and every Shabbos. Thank you so much to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I am so grateful for your friendship and partnership. And be sure to subscribe to our Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can find all of the links to the books and articles and everything that we quote online in the class. You can find it in the text. Again, reading Jewish history in the parsha.substack.com. Yosef was finally seeing his dreams realized. All the brothers were beseeching him for mercy, bowing before him just as his youthful dreams had predicted. Still, Yosef was not fully satisfied. Binyamin was missing, and his earlier dreams had shown a vision of all of the brothers, including Binyamin, bowing before him. Yosef was on a mission, and he knew these dreams needed to be fulfilled. They were part of a much bigger plan. In fact, the Ramban, and you can look up the Ramban, it's on this week's Parsha, of course, in Perek Mem Beis 42. On the ninth pasuk, Membeis pasuk tes, Vayizkor Yosef es hachalomos asher chalam lahem, where the Ramban writes something remarkable, that this is in fact why Yosef never contacted Yaakov the entire time he was in Egypt, a famous question that so many commentators deal with. Why didn't Yosef try to reach out to his father, who thought he was dead, to kind of calm him down? Even though he was only a few days' journey away, he never sent or checked in on his father Yaakov. Why? The Ramban explains, because Yosef understood how important it was for his dreams to be realized. Yosef did not want to interrupt the unfolding of these dreams. So he didn't play around and he didn't try to contact Yaakov. He was waiting for the ultimate fulfillment of those dreams. Looking back, and if you look back at the trajectory of Yosef's life, you find something quite curious and remarkable. The first half of Yosef's life, his earlier dreams led him to being sold into slavery, jealousy with the brothers, alienated from his family, flees the house of Potiphar, and ultimately winds up alone in an Egyptian jail. The next chapter of Yosef's life, however, is full of greatness: redemption from prison, rising to the top of Egyptian political power, and ultimately saving the country from famine. What is the explanation for the disparity in the narrative of Yosef's life? To understand all of this, I want to explore a very relevant and timely chapter in Hasidic history, a battle, the battle, over the ownership of the Chabad library. It was not a given that Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who we know as the seventh Rebbe of Chabad, would assume the mantle as that seventh Rebbe. His father-in-law, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, known as the Rebbe Rayatz, passed away on the 10th of Shvat in 1950. An entire calendar year went by until Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson agreed to assume the leadership of the Hasidus and assume the mantle of Rebbe. He finally agreed, literally to the day, 1 year later, on the 10th of Shvat of 1951, with his famous Maimer, that Hasidic discourse that begins Basi Lagani. After being presented with a letter from his Hasidim beckoning him to accept the leadership as Rebbe, he finally agreed, "You'll have to help me," the Rebbe insisted. The previous Rebbe, the Rebbe Rayatz, had two daughters in America. His third daughter, the youngest, Shena, was murdered in the Holocaust. His oldest daughter, Chana, married Shmaryahu Gerari, known as the Rashag. His middle daughter, Chaya Mushka, married Rav Menachem Mendel, who eventually, as we know, became the seventh Rebbe of Chabad. But the Rashag was 5 years older than the eventual Rebbe and had taken on a significant amount of leadership responsibilities within the movement. Moreover, the Rashag had a son, his name was Barry, who could serve potentially as the eventual heir to Chabad leadership. The Rebbe and Rebbetzin, as many know, were never blessed with children. After the Rebbe assumed the mantle of leadership of Chabad in 1951, with that famous Maimer, that traditional Hasidic discourse, "Basi Lagani, I've come into my garden," the Hasidim were ecstatic. Even his older brother-in-law, the Rashag, or Shmaryahu Gerari, eventually embraced his leadership. His son, the Rashag's son Barry, however, still felt spurned. While he would continue to visit 770, the headquarters of Chabad, where his father and mother lived, and where his uncle served as the Rebbe, he never really accepted his uncle as Rebbe. As Chaim Miller reports in his biography, and it's a really nice biography, Turning Judaism Outwards, the custom at the Rebbe's Passover Seder, Pesach Seder, was that no one would lean in front of the Rebbe. It was a sign of respect. If the Rebbe's there, the others don't lean. At the Rebbe's Seder in 770, Chaim Miller writes in his biography, none none of the attendees leaned except for Barry, the Rebbe's nephew. Beginning in 1984, the divisions within the family grew far more serious. In need of extra money, Barry Gerari began sneaking into the library of his grandfather, who had passed many years earlier, the Rebbe Rayat, and surreptitiously began removing valuable books, svarim, to resell. He was in need of money. It was a valuable library. He was taking books and selling them on the market. In early 1985, it became noticeable that valuable books from this historic library of Chabad were missing. A video system was installed in order to discover the identity of the thief. Lo and behold, they discovered the culprit, Barry Gerari, the Rebbe's nephew. The Rebbe was distressed. This was much more than just about books. Stealing books for resale from the Chabad library was a challenge to the very authenticity of the Rebbe's leadership. Was he in fact the seventh Rebbe of Chabad, or had the movement died along with his father-in-law, the Rebbe Rayat, the sixth Rebbe? As soon as the theft was realized, a public statement was issued by Chabad warning people not to publish these stolen books. I have that, of course, included in our Substack. Agudas Chassidi Chabad had this long letter, not so long, but this letter of a few paragraphs reminding people that they should not be buying these books. They are dangerous. They are stolen property. Barry Gerari stole over 100 books from the library. Of those, he sold over 100, 102 to be precise. Chabad coordinated an effort in order to repurchase the stolen books. They were able to buy back almost all of the ones sold, 94 out of 102, and they had to pay a whopping $433,000. Rav Moshe Bogomolinsky, I think I'm pronouncing that name correctly, I executed that beautifully, if I may say so myself, who wrote the memoir on this entire incident, which is wonderful, of course, linked to in the Substack. He's a dedicated chassid of the Rebbe, and he led much of the effort to track down and retrieve the stolen books. He enlisted the help of Rev Menashe Klein, the famous Rav of Ungvar, who wrote many volumes of Responsa, known as Shilos and Tshuvos, Mishneh Halachos, which are a lot of really fascinating, wonderful stuff in there. And Rav Menashe Klein would urge those who purchased the book to sell them back to the library of Chabad. In Rabbi Bogomolinsky's memoir, he recounts, this is my all-time favorite story. I love this story. He recounts that Rav Menashe Klein was shocked at how valuable some of these svarim were. They were rare books. When Rav Menashe Klein learned that the stolen 1760 Kitzi Haggadah, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, was sold for nearly $150,000, this Haggadah that belonged to the library of the Rebbe, he exclaimed, Vos, $150,000 for a Haggadah? Zicher paro hut alein gestamt sein numen of es. Now, my Yiddish is embarrassing. That shouldn't be a part of the joke. I will forgive you if you laughed. Or if Menashe Klein responds, I'll translate it. He says, what, $150,000 for a Haggadah? It must be Paro himself must have signed it, which is a phenomenal response. How else? Why else would a Haggadah be so expensive? In December of 1985, the dispute was brought to the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York. Agudas Chassidei Chabad versus Gerari would decide who owned the books and, in a larger sense, who was the rightful heir to Chabad. Chabad was represented in court by the great lawyer, defender of religious liberty, Nat Lewin. The judge in the case, Charles P. Sifton, was the son-in-law of the famed theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. I think I'm pronouncing that name correctly. He's super famous. One of the reasons why he's famous, the reason why I love, is because Reinhold Niebuhr, the father-in-law of the judge in this case, was the person who composed the Serenity Prayer that's popularized at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Lord, give me the strength to change the things that I can. Give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot, and give me the wisdom to know the difference. There are a few different Nusachos, a few different versions of it, but that one that I think is most famous was composed by Reinhold Niebuhr. That's the father-in-law of the judge in the case. Lewin was relieved that the judge was connected to such a theologian, given the many theological undertones to the case that was now before him. At the heart of Chabad's claim was that the books did not belong to the Rebbe as an individual, but rather to the Hasidic movement as a whole. Therefore, even Barry Gerari, a grandson, had no claim over these books. To bolster Chabad's position, they pointed to several letters of the Rebbe Rayatz, which explicitly indicated that his library belonged to the Hasidus as a whole. One letter sent by the Rayatz, again, that's the sixth Rebbe of Chabad, Rebbe Yitzchak Yosef Schneerson, one letter that he sent in February of 1946 to Dr. Alexander Marks, the head librarian of the Jewish Theological Seminary, in the hopes of enlisting his help retrieving the books that remained in Europe. The Rebbe writes to Dr. Alexander Marks, and I think it's remarkable that he's writing to the head librarian of JTS that's associated with the conservative movement, and the Rebbe explicitly states these books are the property of Agudas Chasidei Chabad of America and Canada. The case captured the nation. For many, this was their first glimpse into the inner workings and structure of Hasidic communities. The December 18th, 1985 New York Times headline read, "Suit on Books Gives Look at Hasidim." And there's a long article, it was on the front page of the Metro section, I believe, going through this issue of ownership. Who owns the books and what is this lawsuit all about? The Rebbe declined to participate in any depositions related to the case. His wife, however, Rebbe Simchaya Mushko, who was the daughter of the Rayatz, the person whose library these books were stolen from, and was the wife of the current Rebbe, Rebbe Menachem Mendel, and daughter of the previous Rebbe, was deposed for over an hour. The video footage is still available online. It's absolutely remarkable. A lot of it is in English. It is absolutely worth watching, both just for the history and just to understand, and to see the wife of the Rebbe on video is something really, really amazing. When the Rebbetzin was asked whether she thought the library belonged to the Rebbe or to the Hasidim, her response was poignant. "It was for the Hasidim," she explained, "since my father belonged to the Hasidim." In order to explain to Judge Sifton the nature of the Hasidic movements in general and the Chabad movement in specific, Chabad turned to Rabbi Louis Jacobs, who provided testimony to the court based on his extensive scholarship. He's written many books and articles about Hasidus. His testimony was later published along with a foreword by Nat Lewin and a preface by my dearest friend, Menachem Butler. It's published by Shaiki Press. You could read, it's got a preface and a foreword. Menachem writes the preface, Nat Lewin writes the foreword, and there's a lot of really interesting tidbits in there. And in his preface, Lewis explicitly acknowledges, in fact, that Rabbi Jacobs was a controversial choice. There's something famous, a case called the Jacobs Affair, where Rabbi Louis Jacobs was considered for the position of chief rabbi of England for a host of reasons, and it caused a big political stir in England at the time. He was rejected. My friend Menachem Butler often says, I believe that he's the one who coined this, that Rabbi Louis Jacobs is the greatest chief rabbi that Britain never had. Still, even though he was controversial, Chabad remained confident that he would have the scholarly acumen, the language, to make the case for Chabad, and they knew that he would be sympathetic. Rabbi Jacobs' testimony is nearly 200 pages of court transcript. Throughout, Rabbi Jacobs gives a masterclass in the nature of Hasidic movements. He states emphatically, "It is true that you can't have a Hasid without your Rebbe, but you can't have a Rebbe without Hasidim," highlighting that bilateral relationship that goes in two directions between a Rebbe and the Hasidim. On January 6, 1987, the 5th of Teves, the court ruled in favor of Chabad. The books belonged to the Hasidim. The Hasidim, in a sense, vindicated the leadership of the Rebbe. "Didon Netzach," Hasidim exclaimed, "we won, and this day, Hey Teves," which is sometimes even called Didon Netzach, "has become enshrined in Chabad and even in the larger Jewish community, where the Rebbe proclaimed the 5th of Teves, an ongoing day of the celebration of books and Torah learning," which is why I thought it was so important to talk about this incident in Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where we celebrate every week books and Torah learning. He urged his Hasidim to buy books, learn from holy books, and continue in the work of Yosef, not just Yosef in reference to his father-in-law, the Rebbe Rayatz, who was his first name was Yosef, but also the biblical personality Yosef, where the Rebbe, in one of his early, I believe his first public presentation after Hey Teves on that victory, invokes the memory of Yosef, who had the courage to hold on to his Yiddishkeit no matter the odds, no matter what he was up against. "Torah and Yiddishkeit should be spread," the Rebbe urged, "and our wellsprings should go outwards to the point where nothing else lies behind." That's what the Rebbe said again in that first discourse following Hey Teves. Kaves, as to read it in the original Hebrew, Hahara mikol ha'amor le'el, the message, the directive from everything that we have just said, b'degogea le'poel, what's relevant right now, lichios im hazman, to live with the times, a famous Chabad statement that doesn't mean to become very modern. It means to take the timeless Torah values, the values of each parsha, and bring it into your life. And the parsha of this week was the story of Yosef. Yesh lehishtadel lemale ulahashlim es hakavana hapanimis b'shlicha shel Elokim. We have to put an effort and complete that inner intentionality in our mission for God. Shehoisa lefisha ba'opin shel helam behester, that there was a moment where it was very hidden, and now that we have this public victory, k'dei shemitok simcha v'tov levav yosifu b'yeser she'esu b'yeser os ba'avodaso shel Yosef. We should come with joy and with excitement to add on even more passion in this avoda of Yosef. And that is in quotes in the Rebbe's discourse, because again, it is a reference to the biblical Yosef and his father-in-law, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the Rebbe Rayatz. And he says, how do we do that? Behafatzas haTorah v'hayadas v'hamayanos chutza, with the spreading out the wellsprings of Torah outwards, ad l'chutza she'ein chutza mimenu. We should spread it out so far that nothing lies beyond it. Which brings us back to our parsha. There's an old Hasidic story that I think I first heard from Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Twersky. A Hasid walks into his Rebbe's chambers and says, I think I'm ready to start my own Hasidic movement. The Rebbe asks, how do you know this? Well, the Hasid explains, every night I have a vivid dream that I am a Rebbe for 300 Hasidim. Surely, a recurring dream like this must be a sign that I should start my own Hasidus. The Rebbe smiles and responds, you don't start your own Hasidus when you have a dream that you have 300 Hasidim. You start your own Hasidic movement when 300 Hasidim have a dream that you are the Rebbe. A Rebbe's dreams is not for himself, but rather for the self-actualization of the movement. And this distinction stands at the heart of the story of Yosef. His entire life is spent dreaming, but the first chapter of his life, jealousy of the brothers, sold into slavery, escape from Potiphar's home and jail, is drastically different from the leadership and power of the second half of his life. What is the difference? The first half of Yosef's life, he was preoccupied with his own dreams. In the second chapter of his life, Yosef begins to interpret the dreams of others. True leadership is not fulfilling our dreams, but like the biblical Yosef and Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, leadership is about helping others actualize their dreams. That bilateral symbiotic relationship between a leader and his community, between a chassid and the Rebbe, between Yosef in our parsha and the dreams that he interpreted for others. So thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. Be sure to subscribe to our Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our dearest friends, Janet and Lior, Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem for your extraordinarily kind support and friendship over all these years. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.